Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you today.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
Very good. Good. We're going to have a little fun today.
That's right.
A mini reunion.
That's right.
I recall, and everybody recalls, that you did work a little bit, in the congressional office, but we also had a chief of staff back then who had been in and out and had all the positions, knows everything about Congress. I'm so shocked that he left Washington.
That's right.
Yeah, I can't believe it, with
Insider.
All his experience. Now, and that's Jeff Dice, who is now president of the Mises Institute. So we're very honored to have him, and we're going to solve all the problems of the world, the economic problems especially. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Ron. Dr. Paul, I did leave Washington. I went for the glamour of Auburn, Alabama instead, so here I am.
Yeah, that was a moral safe place to go compared to what's going on in Washington. Well, I'll tell you what, people often ask me, Jeff, were things as bad when you were up there? And I would always say, well, I got along pretty well, and I just ignored those silly fights, and it didn't seem so, it didn't seem that bad. But the more I think about that, you know, even though I lived through that and didn't get in those silly battles, I do think that whole system is a lot worse. Do you sense that Washington's a lot different than we were there?
Well, I think it is. Just 5 years have changed everything radically. And, you know, these members of Congress can't even hold a civilized town hall anymore. So the whole thing is, I think, become more hateful, more intense, and that's just a symptom of the fact that the federal government controls too much of our country.
Right. And you know, I'm doing a little writing right now, and I'm a slow writer, but what I'm writing about is the bankruptcy of the country, the financial bankruptcy and the moral bankruptcy. And I think these problems that we see, why people don't get along and all this, I think we're bankrupt. They don't want to admit it, and there's always a limit. You know, there's a limit to how far governments can push things, and they certainly have tried to do that in money. For instance, you know, they said that we will not honor the commitment to gold, and of course Roosevelt, and then made sure that we couldn't own gold, and then there was a breakdown of Bretton Woods. So therefore, government broke down and fell apart because they could not even, you know, maintain that. And if that was the early signs of bankruptcy. But I think it's much worse now. It's very emotional, very contentious. But I still think that there's a bit of cooperation that goes on that they don't admit. Because, you know, as much as they hate each other, why do they pass the budgets? They've never had one party pass the budget. You know, it's usually the both parties come together and they spend the money because the big picture is, or whoever's running things behind the scenes, are all for these wars and the welfare, and they can't stand the thought of what would happen if we quit deficit financing.
Well, it's true. And the real measure, I think, of a member of Congress is whether he or she votes against the annual appropriations bills. I think that and the budget are probably the two most important votes of all. But we can talk all about what kind of government we want to have, whether it should be more progressive, more conservative, more libertarian. But at the end of the day, the actions of members of Congress speak a lot louder than their words. And those actions are to just ratchet this thing up forever and forever.
Daniel. Yeah,
well, Jeff, well, welcome to the show and happy to have you. You know, we at the Ron Paul Institute are always happy to work with the Mises Institute. We've had joint conferences, and we've had you and Lou speak at our conferences and vice versa. So it's always great. And the reason is that you're primarily dealing with the financial economic side. We're primarily dealing with the foreign policy, war and peace and civil liberties. But the thing is, the Fed is the key. And that's what the thread that runs through both of our organizations. And that's something we have to hammer home, I think, all the time. This is the key. But I want to get to our topic. There's a lot to talk about. But the main issue we want to talk about today is negative interest rates, you know, and they're coming. You know, they're in Europe now, and they're coming onto our shores. We saw a little clip you had with Rick Sanchez the other day about the issue, and you made the point, and it's a good starting point for the topic, I think. No one in the world would lend you $1,000 in the anticipation of getting $900 back from you when you pay it back. But that's essentially where we are with negative interest rates. Maybe you can extrapolate a little bit on that.
Well, central bankers are pretty good at obscuring common sense thoughts with gibberish. They want us to believe that this is all some sort of technical exercise in policy and rate setting that's too complex for us to understand. But of course, we all understand conceptually that no one would loan you $1,000 in exchange for $900 at some period in the future, because that loan entails risk. The lender could die, the borrower could default or abscond. So we understand, I think, inherently, as part of human nature, that if we're going to forego the use of our money today, we want to be paid something in the future for that risk. The only time we would accept $900 back in exchange for $1,000 is, of course, if we're worried about getting only $800 back. And that's what's happening when governments and treasuries and central banks get together to, in effect, engage in price setting. They're fixing the price of interest rates. And in some cases, in certain European bonds, both sovereign and corporate, they've managed to fix those prices below zero. So this is not a natural market phenomenon. This is the result of central bank interference with the economy. And if you listen to Alan Greenspan, who talked about this just a week or so ago, unfortunately, this mania of negative interest rates is coming to the United States sometime soon.
Yeah, and the way I see this, Jeff, is it's complex. It's going to get worse, and it's the sign of what is coming. And they're not going to be able to tinker around the edges and think they're going to solve this problem. For instance, I think that the negative interest rates distracts a little bit about what's happening right now, because the negative rates are there, and the repurchases markets this week, the last several days, didn't have enough money to buy back their securities, and they look for overnight borrowing. And rates shot up to 10%. So that was the market demanding, moving in and saying, and then the Fed comes in immediately, because that's Wall Street, immediately said, well, the minimum we have is $75 billion in whatever is necessary. And this is going on longer than they ever predicted. But then again, what about the consumer debt? The consumer debt is over $4 trillion. And there's $4,000 on the average person on their credit card. Those interest rates go up. And I'm told you could be paying 15, 16, or 17%. And I see this as just participating in the division between Wall Street and Main Street, because Wall Street gets bailed out. And these guys that can't pay their bills, like in the last recession, you know, the bailouts went to the very wealthy. So the market is always speaking. And I think we can see a glimpse of that. But I think that might fit into your argument that it's coming to an end. This just can't last forever.
No, it can. Of course, it is a big wealth transfer from savers to profligate governments, because average people cannot go out and earn a rate of interest on simple investments. They can't go get a CD or mutual fund and make any money. So governments love low interest rates because debt service is a huge part of their budget. Right now, the U.S. federal government is going to spend next year about $400 billion on debt service, and that's with relatively low interest rates. Now, all the outstanding treasury debt represents a range of different interest rates in place at the time that debt was issued. But nonetheless, we have 2% rates, and it's $400 billion a year. Imagine if we had 5% rates. This would be the single biggest line item in the federal budget, ahead of defense, ahead of Social Security, ahead of Medicare. And you know what's so fascinating about all this and so egregious is, as you point out, you know, people with bad credit, poor people, are still going to Rent-A-Center and effectively paying 25-30% to obtain appliances, let's say, at Rent-A-Center. No, I don't want to knock them as one particular company. People with bad credit are paying 20% on credit card debt. So all of this negative interest, of course, helps the real estate industry. It helps the banking industry. It helps the construction industry. But it doesn't help mom and pop. It doesn't help the little guy. And it really represents a wealth transfer that's just so hidden. It's such a huge story, and it's not being told.
Yeah, and I think, though, that it's going to be heard, because, as I said, I think this is a sign that things are coming to an end. But we think of these details in the day-to-day activity of interest rates and how the little guys get stuck with it and the big guys get the money. But you really have to go back to the nature of money and how the money's been destroyed and the morality of money. The founders were very interested in having honest money, which meant that the Congress nor the federal nor the central banks, or nobody was allowed to just print money out of thin air. And that's what they're doing. Where did the Fed get that $75 billion that they started bailing out banks in the last couple of days? That's created out of thin air. I think sometimes, Jeff, this might not fit well, but it's almost like of electronic greenback era. You know, they just put it out there and pass it out, and they distribute it. And I think that it's the nature of money, the fact that the system is dishonest. The founders thought it should be something that has integrity, that you can't print and you can't debase. You don't. You just can't have people, you know, just running up debt and turning that into money. And just think of all the things that have occurred because of that system. It didn't happen the day after the Federal Reserve was established, but it didn't take long for them to start abusing it, because debt started accumulating in World War I. And then they gave us depression and all these things. It's amazing how long this had lasted. But people should see this as a moral issue, if nothing else, because it is stealing, it is counterfeiting, it's counterproductive, it serves the interests of the people who want special interests, and the little guy gets stuck with you know, all the problems. So I think that we should talk about the moral issue of money more often. And there was a time when I would make a statement that the two issues that I could never use on the House floor to help defeat a bill would be a constitutional issue and a moral issue. But I don't think we should give up on that.
Well, it's so true. It's not just that monetary policy as currently being promulgated in the West isn't working. It's that it's also deeply immoral. You know, if any of your listeners have the desire, there's a absolutely wonderful book by Professor Guido Holzmann in Germany called The Ethics of Money Production. It's actually a slim book. It's not too daunting. And I think this is the kind of show where we should actually encourage people to go out and read some real sources and some primary sources and educate themselves. There's an ethical component to this. When money is debased, when it becomes meaningless, when interest rates are driven very, very low, societies become upended. I mean, healthy societies accumulate capital. In a healthy society, most individuals produce more than they consume, and thus, on a societal level and also on an individual and family level, they leave something to the next generation. And that's not just purely what we might think of as economic capital, that's also cultural and knowledge and all kinds of capital. But nonetheless, they leave something for the future. They save for a rainy day. They save for their own retirements, and with a little luck, they have something to leave to their children and grandchildren. When we don't do this anymore, when we encourage, via low and negative interest rates, the consumption of everything, we really become a different kind of society. We become a high time preference society, a society where saving money is for chumps. So how does that trickle down? How do we measure that? It's almost impossible, but there are a million small ways. You might say, well, you know, instead of saving up $15,000 in cash for that used car, I'll just go borrow $35,000 for that fancier new one because, you know, I'm getting a 2% loan. Or, you know, instead of driving the family to Disney or whatever this year, let's just take that European vacation that cost $10,000 and put it on some credit cards. I mean, there's no telling how this filters down. But we do know that high time preferences in economics correlate to bad behavior in life. The idea that we live for today, the idea that we don't work on ourselves and self-improvement or educating ourselves or putting off purchases or doing all kinds of things where we give up something today in order to benefit tomorrow, or better yet, to have our children and grandchildren benefit tomorrow. And that's the societal and cultural and moral implication of all this. And just because we can't measure it, Dr. Paul, doesn't mean it's not real and that it's not happening.
All right. Daniel?
Yeah, it's like Veruca Salt. I don't care how, I want it now, right? But I think it's important to drill deeper into these kind of more abstract moral aspects of the negative interest rates and zero interest rates. And the one that I know that you're interested in, and you've touched on it just now, but I wouldn't mind talking a little bit more about it. How does this, and people may not associate this right away with, how do you think this might affect interpersonal relationships, family relationships, our aggressive foreign policy, war? You know, you talk about how it changes us as a people and as persons, as individuals. How would you sort of look at an entire society and how it changes our policy and affects our foreign policy?
Well, it really is a deep question, because a high time preference society might be quicker to divorce, for example.
Yeah.
Trade in one spouse for that shinier, newer spouse. If we look at the really awful intergenerational war between the baby boomers and the Gen Zers, I guess I should say, millennials and Gen Z below them, There was a lot of divorce in the baby boom generation, more so than in the World War II generation above them. And there's also been, since the 70s, when the boomers were coming into their age, a lot of profligate monetary inflation in this country. And as a result, things like the cost of college has gone up exponentially. Young people now have to borrow and spend $40,000 a year to go to their universities. And so they look at their baby boomer parents, who perhaps enjoyed a much cheaper college experience. And, you know, their parents are saying to them, well, you know, you just got to work up the ladder at your job, and you got to pay for college, you know, using your summer job mowing lawns or something. And these things aren't available to them. And so it actually creates intergenerational strife. Hmm. So debasing the money, you know, I don't want to draw a one-to-one correlation, because we're libertarians. We don't believe in determinism. We believe that individuals are responsible, you know, in their own self, for their actions, but there is an incentive here. The debasement of currency and money and savings really does tend to debase us culturally and socially and individually. So it's something we have to look at, and I think personally, as a Gen Xer in between, I have some sympathy for the millennials. You know, I was able, with my parents' help, to get through college without debt, and that's something we shouldn't look lightly on. That's a real burden for millennials and Gen Z behind them.
Yeah, tell me about it.
You know, we mention a lot about how easy money, the Federal Reserve, buys the debt and finances war. If we had to pay for the war as we went along, we'd have a lot less wars, I'll tell you. But I think they create a new war that is ongoing, and that's the class warfare going on in this country. Because I believe that fiat currency and the way the Fed works, even if you don't even think about the bailouts, it generally is beneficial to the rich. They get the money first. And then the poor people, you know, they have prices going up faster than their wages go up. So there is a class warfare going on there. But I think right now, when you see the bailouts, whether it was during the recession 10 years ago or what's going on now, this is really food for fodder for the socialists. See what those capitalists are doing? You know, look at this. The people are out on the streets, and the Wall Street's getting bailed out, and the people who can't pay their mortgages and they have all this debt, but they get no help whatsoever. So the socialists pop in and say, see, that's what it is. And I think we have a job, because we have too many conservative business people are very, very interventionist, and they don't care about the deficit. They don't care if there is a subject called liquidation of debt that's inevitable. They seem to want to ignore that, or they deny it. But I think that this system that we have now is aggravating this class warfare, and we need to make sure that the people understand that we don't have to defend this system, and we shouldn't be, you know, and give a little bit of help to the socialists who claim, well, we just need more government, not less.
Well, of course, socialists love to plan every aspect of the economy, including the money. And as you point out, money is never neutral. This is something Mises pointed out over 100 years ago. Nobody presses a magic button and puts $1 million in every American's bank account tomorrow. And even if they did, it wouldn't create any new goods or services in the economy. Prices would just adjust quickly, and none of us would be any better or worse off. So when new money and credit is introduced in the system, it reaches certain people first, and people closer to government and central banking tend to be the early recipients, like, for example, defense contractors, for example, investment banks on Wall Street. So people who avail themselves of new money and credit earlier in the cycle do better. And, you know, the less affluent people with lower incomes, with less savings, with less retirement money in the bank, who get this money later, you know, prices rise, and they find themselves not being able to save because interest rates are so low. But the question I would ask anyone on the left, progressives in general, and of course people on the right as well, but especially this crop of Democratic presidential candidates who want to talk forever and ever about inequality, is if you're not talking about the Fed, you're not serious about inequality. The two are inextricably linked, and the Federal Reserve is the biggest driver by far of inequality in our country and in our economy. So I don't want to see any of these Democratic candidates talking about this and that tax if they're not talking about the Fed.
Right.
That's Daniel. Great, Jeff. I know when Chris pulls our clips, I hope he pulls that one, because that's a great little comment there. I'm going to close on my end Of course, Dr. Paul will close after me, but I just want to say that someday our dream at RPI is to set up sort of a center on banking and war, because it's such an important topic. But I do want to say that we'd love to have you, at our next conference talking about some of this, because I think it's so important. It crosses all political boundaries, and people don't understand it. So if you can bear coming up to D.C. And joining us next time, Jeff, we'd love to have you. And thanks for joining us today.
Very good. And I too, want to thank Jeff for being here. I'm going to make a real short comment, because my big concern overall on all that I have watched and seen, in Washington, and in particular the monetary policy and foreign policy, the bottom line is we keep losing our liberty. People don't seem to have high priority of that. And as long as we have the current monetary system and the spending programs, we cannot, because the more the government spends, the less liberty that we have. And Jeff, I do once again want to thank you, but I'd like to give you a chance to make another comment if you'd like.
Well, I think this is the single most important untold story of our day, is this unprecedented experiment in monetary policy that really began around 2000 with Alan Greenspan, but went into hyperdrive both at the Fed in the US and the ECB in Europe and the Bank of Japan and others in 2008. And I really wish financial journalists would be a little less credulous about what's going on with these supposed experts, and a little more investigative, not only about what they're doing, but how different it is from anything in human history.
Wonderful. And once again, Jeff, thanks for being here. And I want to thank our audience for tuning in today. And please come back soon to the Liberty Report.